From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week, we're going to the limits, like to the edge of our identities, with Puerto Rican hip-hop stars Calle 13.
I think that I like to make the people question themselves about everything, because that's the way I am.
And what happens when people push the wrong buttons while flirting?
Like, what they say when they approach me is, "Oh my God, you look like Lucy Liu." I'm like, I look nothing like Lucy Liu, but I'm glad you're aware of one Asian actress.
And I talk with former Secretary of Labor Hilda Solis as she runs for a new position in Los Angeles. All this and more as we talk about the people and things that are really pushing it. That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. We're going to start today's show by speaking with an artist who's known for pushing all sorts of limits, even of good taste. Esto va suave, sabe bien suave, 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 sabe bien suave. Esto va suave, quiere un poco de casabe pa' ver cómo sabe. Aunque no quepa, métele con pepa. De pura cepa le someto a cualquier arepa. Calle 13 began as a group of potty-mouthed jokesters out of Puerto Rico. They won attention for their alternative take on reggaeton music, full of over-the-top sexual humor. That was 9 years ago. But since then, a lot has changed for the group. Over the course of the next three albums, Calle 13's music became more politically engaged, addressing issues like social justice and poverty in Latin America. Soy lo que dejaron, soy toda la sobra de lo que se robaron, un pueblo escondido en la cima, mi piel es de cuero, por eso aguanta cualquier clima. Now, Calle 13 has become one of the most important groups on the continent, especially beloved by university students and young activists all over Latin America. Earlier this year, the band released its fifth studio album titled Multiviral, or Multiviral. The music is still funny at moments, political in others, but more than anything, Multiviral is Calle 13's most introspective album yet, which frequently addresses the big questions about what we're doing here on planet Earth. To hear a little bit more about their new album, we're joined in the studio by René Pérez Joglar, who's also known as Residente, the group's rapper, lyricist, and fiery frontman. René, it's great to have you back on Latino USA.
Thank you.
So, René, 9 years later, Calle 13 basically has developed a reputation as a group that, I mean, essentially does what it wants, that, you know, you're anti-conformist, you basically defy authority whenever you can. So, René, would you say that you are, in fact, all about pushing boundaries? Is that how you see yourself as an artist?
I think that I like to make the people question themselves about everything, because that's the way I am. I don't know, I have too many questions, and I just work with that.
So you mean like philosophical questions, existential questions, life questions?
Yeah, and stupid questions, like normal, regular questions. Like for this album, the new album, it was more like a reflection. Like I had more time to think about everything, and it's more existential, I think.
And were you always this questioning little kid when you were growing up on La Isla? Were you always like, "Mama, ¿por qué? Papá, ¿por qué?"
I think every kid made questions, and sometimes they receive good answers. I think that I received good answers. I grew up with my mom being an actress and my dad, he was a lawyer, but it's a good one, you know, for the people. So maybe that mix between both, I think it's me, I think.
Do you remember the first time that you read Eduardo Galeano?
The first book that I read about him was Las Venas Abiertas, that a friend of mine give it to me.
So the open veins of Latin America.
Yeah, the open veins of Latin America. And actually, I didn't finish it. I'm not a good reader. Like a lot of people think that I'm always reading, and I have ADD, so I have like attention deficit disorder. So what I like about Galeano is that I can read his short stories, and he's not pretentious, and I have fun reading him.
So it's probably the first time that Eduardo Galeano was actually put to music, and it sounds extraordinary.
Oriol Val, que se ocupa de los recién nacidos en un hospital de Barcelona, dice que el primer gesto humano es el abrazo. Después de salir al mundo...
We are a big fan of Eduardo Galeano's too. And one of the things that I love about putting him on our show is his voice and his timbre. And in that story that he tells, every time that I hear it, I'm like almost moved to tears. It's a story about the simplicity of life and death. Why did you decide to include Eduardo reading this story in your new album?
He has a great voice to record. And yeah, and I invited him. We met here in New York, and we drank, and we had a good time, and then he did it in Uruguay, yeah.
So when people say that you and the Calle 13 have become a very political band, doing things like putting a political writer and a poet, you know, what's your response to that?
It's more relaxed. It's just like a normal human being trying to write things that are happening, social stuff, because we are surrounded by social things. So that's the way I write. But they try to put stamps on you, like revolutionary, or it's more simple, you know.
Well, what is the simplicity then of your message?
I think it's a documentation. It's like a documentary of what is happening right now, and you just have to look around, and it's like drawing something that you're looking the same way you're doing when you're writing and when you're making music.
So on your new album, Multiviral, there's this standout track called El Aguante, which, you know, what's the translation? Put up with? Resist?
The resistance, or, yeah.
I love that song.
Yeah, me too.
I love that song. Lo que viene, aguantamos aunque tengamos los segundos contados. Nuestro cuerpo aguanta hasta 15 minutos ahorcado. Aguantamos latigazos que nos corten los dos brazos. Fracturas en cualquier hueso, 3 semanas como un yeso. Aguantamos todo el tiempo las ganas de ir al baño para ver el cometa Halley. Hay que aguantar 70 años. Aguantamos la escuela, la facultad, el instituto. A la hora de cenar, nos aguantamos los... It's really a song about celebrating life, even though you're saying resist. It's celebrating life.
The idea started out because of the music. My brother was doing like an Irish kind of folkloric music. And yeah, I was thinking about my friends in Ireland, like the way they drink and they resist. They don't get drunk. So that's why I start writing about how much our body resists different things, and then the history, historically, how much human beings, you know, have resisted everything.
It's incredibly hopeful, the song. On the other side of that, you have a song that is not Aguante, it's Adentro. And of course, there's this very famous video, right, in which you, René, actually destroy the Maserati that you had bought, and you destroy it with a baseball bat, and then you send it over a cliff. Which, of course, when somebody told me that you had a Maserati, I was like, no, it couldn't have been.
Yeah, a lot of people, they didn't know that, because I bought it like a long time ago. And then like 3 months later, I thought that it was very stupid and I felt wrong. And then I start traveling and knowing different part of the world. And I thought, man, I don't want to use this car anymore. So I just destroyed the car.
You literally just destroyed the car, and we saw it in the video. Let's talk just a little bit now about Puerto Rico. you are firmly rooted in the Puerto Rican experience. You are firmly rooted in your political experience of wanting independence for Puerto Rico. And you just did this recently in a concert in Mexico. You asked everybody to know more about Oscar López Rivera. So even though you may have this very worldwide writing of your music, there are many things that you want very specifically people to understand about Puerto Rico. And one of them is the fact that there are political prisoners.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you have Oscar López Rivera, that he's like 32 years in prison. You know, they talk that this is the land of the free. And if you do that in Latin America, I know that in CNN they're going to talk about, oh, look, those countries with those dictators and everything. And here you have a guy, because of his political beliefs, in prison for 32 years. It's crazy.
Do you think that most people who know your music actually know and understand the politics of Puerto Rico? Or
it's difficult to know about a country if you didn't grow up there, you know? I try to avoid any political things outside Puerto Rico and the U.S. Both are my countries, even though I want to be independent, but we are part of the U.S., sadly. Not because I don't like the people from here, but just because I want to be like the people from here with one flag and free.
Conocedor de múltiples maniobras, el viejo en la mezcla de lo mejor de las obras, el mundo explotó y quedó desierto, y el viejo heredó lo mejor.
Finally, there is a wonderful song, one of the highlights of your album, Así de Grandes Son Las Ideas. And it's just so poetic.
A sangre fría opera todos los momentos, todos los minutos que se pierden por ahí, los puede recuperar con un bisturí. Estira los segundos para que se hagan más largos. También hace trasplantes de momentos amargos y si continúa la amargura.
What is for you the power of ideas?
Yeah, ideas. An idea is everything right now. Like you can live or you can die because of ideas. This song is about an idea that never died. And the idea wants to die, and it tries to commit suicide to give space to new ideas. But, yeah.
Well, for all of your ideas, René, residente of Calle 13, thank you so much. Your ideas and your music are very powerful and mean a lot to all of us at Latino USA.
Thank you.
Se hacen eternas cuando las quieren y siempre viven y nunca mueren. Cuando se duermen son indefensas y se despiertan cuando las piensas y las atienden.
René Pérez Joglar, a.k.a. Residente, is one half of the group Calle 13. Their new album is Multiviral, or Multiviral. And for more on the music that we played in this segment, stop by latinousa.org. Coming up on Latino USA.
There are women who don't have access to abortions because they don't have the money. The problem is that these women are, in the end, obliged to continue a pregnancy they don't want, or they're obliged to get an abortion in bad conditions.
When abortion is completely illegal under any circumstance. That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan.
Pacífico, mujer completa.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Abortion has been legal across the United States since 1973, but in recent years, lawmakers in several states have been working to restrict access to abortions. So what does it look like when abortions are always illegal? Like in Chile. Abortions there were outlawed in 1989 during the final months of Augusto Pinochet's dictatorship. And the penalty for getting an abortion is prison. Ailish O'Neill tells us now about two women who pushed the limits. And out of consideration for their privacy, we're going to use only their first names.
Rosa is standing outside the jail where she spent 3 months as an inmate back in 1993. At the time, she was 23 years old.
I got pregnant. I confided that to a friend, thinking he was really my friend. He told me that I was going to ruin my youth with a baby. Why have a baby if I had to work? I was going to lose my job. All of that.
Not long after this conversation, Rosa's friend, who was a paramedic, gave her an abortion in his house. She claims she was drugged and can't remember the operation.
I remember that afterwards I cried. I went to a friend's house and she asked me why I was acting so strange. I didn't tell her anything. I only wanted to lie down. I felt very tired and very cold.
Rosa says her paramedic friend used unsterilized instruments. So fearing an infection, she went to a hospital.
A gynecologist told me that for him to save my life, I had to tell him the truth. The doctor got me to trust him, and that same doctor notified the police. So a policeman arrived, he handcuffed me to a bed, and it was humiliating.
Rosa was in the hospital under police custody for several days before she was discharged and brought to prison. Then, she spent 3 months in jail and an additional 3 years on parole. All of this happened more than 20 years ago, and it's not clear how the same situation would unfold today. As far as reproductive rights activists in Chile know, no one's been put in jail recently for having an abortion. But it's still illegal in all cases, and a 3 to 5 year prison sentence for women who get clandestine abortions is still on the books.
We are one of the, if I'm not mistaken, 5 countries in the world that don't allow abortion under any circumstance. And I'd say that's a privilege.
Patricia Gonel calls herself a pro-life activist. She networks with various anti-abortion groups here in Chile. There are plenty of them. 90% of Chileans are Catholics or conservative Protestants, and Chile is one of Latin America's most socially conservative countries.
There are a lot of people that think it's backwards, but it's not, because we're talking about protecting human life, you know? And there are countries that are now trying to backpedal.
One of those countries is the U.S. In South Dakota, for example, lawmakers tried to make abortion a felony. Other states have trigger laws in place, measures that would outlaw abortions immediately if Roe v. Wade were overturned. But does outlawing abortions really end them? It may not. Reproductive rights researchers estimate there are between 120,000 and 160,000 clandestine abortions in Chile every year. That's 8 per 1,000 Chileans, compared to 4 in the U.S.
The woman's going to arrive, she's going to be hospitalized quickly, the operation will be done quickly, and then she has to leave quickly.
Dr. Guillermo Galán is a gynecologist who specializes in sexual and reproductive health. He lives and works in Santiago, Chile, and he supports the legalization of abortion. He says clandestine abortions are usually done in cosmetic surgery clinics by practitioners who risk jail time because they want to make money. Abortions under the best conditions cost about $3,000. That's 3 months' pay for someone who makes the country's median income, and 7 months for someone who makes minimum wage. Cheaper abortions, done by a midwife or paramedic, are riskier.
There are women who don't have access to abortions because they don't have the money. The problem is that these women are, in the end, obliged to continue a pregnancy they don't want, or they're obliged to get an abortion in bad conditions.
There is another option early in a pregnancy. Certain hormones taken as pills or injections can cause a woman's body to expel the fetus. That was the route taken by Alejandra. She got pregnant when she was 17, which made her mom ashamed.
When I told her that I was pregnant, her reaction was to put her head in her hands and say, "Let me see what I can do."
Her mom went to a woman who ran a clandestine clinic from her house.
They're nurses that don't work publicly, but rather from their homes. So my mom went to talk to her, and this woman told her that there was an injection that makes you menstruate, and when one is pregnant, it can cause the loss of the fetus.
The injections cost about $15. Today, the primary drug used to end pregnancies is misoprostol, available on the black market for a little over $100. The results are about the same as what Alejandra experienced after her mom gave her the injections.
Si no me recuerdo, fue como un día antes de mi cumpleaños, justamente que voy al baño y boto la guaguita.
Alejandra says it was the day before her 18th birthday that she went to the bathroom and expelled the fetus. Afterwards, she had to go to class.
I went to school, and I was a mess. I arrived, and my classmates asked me what was wrong, because I cried through the whole class. And I said that I fought with my mom. I never told anyone what happened. Never, ever did anyone find out. If this happened to me again, or if I could turn back time, I would never have done it.
Ninguna mujer quiere abortar.
No woman wants to get an abortion. What she needs is help. Women get abortions for three reasons: fear, pressure, often familial pressure, and the feeling of abandonment, of solitude. So if you stand by her, you calm her, you let her know that she's not alone, she won't get an abortion.
But the tide may be turning against this view. According to a 2010 survey by a Chilean university, a majority of Chileans support legal abortions when the life of the woman or fetus is in danger. In Santiago's Bustamante Park, many passersby said President Michelle Bachelet should legalize abortion in those cases.
I'm in favor of abortion when it's a therapeutic abortion, either to save the mother's life or when the fetus has problems and won't be able to survive.
There should be, like, requirements. So if the woman doesn't have the ability to take care of the child, she should get an abortion. But not everyone who wants to has the right to kill someone.
I think that it should be legalized, because even though it's not legal, it's still practiced illegally. And so I think that both for safety and so people can make their own decisions, though I wouldn't get an abortion, I think that it should be legalized.
And change might be on the horizon. In May, the director of Chile's Ministry of Women announced that the government is working on a bill that would legalize abortion in three cases: rape, or when the woman's or fetus's life is in danger. Also, the health ministry instructed doctors to maintain medical secrets and not to testify in abortion cases. For Latino USA, I'm Ailish O'Neill in Santiago, Chile.
For more information on the measures some U.S. states have considered to outlaw abortion, go to our website, latinousa.org. When President Barack Obama chose his first Secretary of Labor, he made a historic choice. He chose Congresswoman Hilda Solis from California. Not only would she become the first Latina to serve in a U.S. cabinet, but she was the daughter of a Teamster and a factory worker who was picked to head the U.S. Department of Labor. She left the cabinet at the end of Obama's first term and returned home to California, the state where almost one-third of all U.S. Latinos live. Now, Solis is running for office, hoping to become a county supervisor of Los Angeles. Secretary Hilda Solis joins us from her campaign office in El Monte, California. Secretary Solis, thank you for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria. It's good to talk to you.
Secretary, for people outside of Los Angeles who maybe don't understand the city or the way it functions, what exactly
is county supervisor, and why is it such an important role in politics?
Well, it's a really critical position to hold right now because there is such a high concentration of people who live in Los Angeles County. In this area alone, there are 10 million people that live in LA County. And this one seat that I am running for in a supervisorial seat one, there are 2 million people. And it is a seat that was created through court proceedings and lawsuits because of lack of Latino representation. And this lawsuit to make sure that we had a level playing field for people that resided here took place back in the 90s. And as a result, we had a Latina that was actually elected back then. Her name is Gloria Molina, Supervisor Molina. The legacy, I think, here is that it's so important to continue to have continuity, that our community continue to have representation, especially Latinos or Latinas. And the fact still remains that there's still only one Latina that's been elected, that's been reelected for this position. And if you look across the board, even in Los Angeles, even the city council, out of their more than a dozen members, there's only one woman who's a Latina. So we have a long ways to go, even though our population and our numbers show that women, especially Latinas, are gaining in numbers, but we're not gaining in political positions. And that's bothersome.
Secretary, people think about the fact that you were part of the Obama administration, the Secretary of Labor. They think that, you know, in terms of impact and a Latina in politics, that that's pretty high up. Now, when you compare that to being part of the, being a county supervisor in L.A., how does it match up, you know, a federal position versus a position based in Los Angeles?
Well, actually, you can have a greater impact locally. You don't have to wait 5 or 10 years to see a legislation pass or an amendment adopted, because we actually act as a quasi-judicial, executive, and legislative body. Whatever happens in LA County will help lead the rest of the country. And in many ways, that has happened. And just in terms of the economy, we're viewed as the 19th largest economy in the world. And people don't really understand that. We touch just about every a fact of life that you can imagine here in Los Angeles, whether it's caring for the elderly, taking care of foster children, making sure that we end and prevent domestic violence, running the courts, the jail system, healthcare implementation, education, as well as economic development and job creation. Those are all part of what the county's involved in.
Even though this position has that level of impact there, and with a large Latino electorate in the Los Angeles County, you have real concerns about low voter turnout. So how healthy would you say is the Latino electorate in your area?
Over the last few years, we've seen more Latinos become registered through naturalization. Obviously, there was a big push after 187, if people recall, where Governor Wilson really went after the Latinos. And what it really caused was a reaction, the reverse, was that more people actually became naturalized and said, wait a minute, I'm not going to let this happen to me or to my family members. I'm going to get registered and vote. And what I'm concerned about is that typically in presidential elections, you see big voter turnout of our Democratic base. And many Latinos, as you know, the majority are registered Democrats. So this is an off year, and we figure that there may be more, you know, more or less fewer people coming out to vote, unfortunately. And we really want to drive that home, that people need to understand the importance of getting out and voting early, and trying to get people to understand it's important that you don't have to miss a day of work. You can also vote by mail. And our community has to get, I think, a little bit better used to that, especially for newer immigrants, because they don't understand that out here, no one is going to supposedly tamper with that ballot once it's mailed in, unlike perhaps their home countries where there have been fraud and violations of voting rights.
So there's a lot of talk about political apathy among the young, but you say that you've actually had a lot of young volunteers in your campaign.
Right. It's been amazing. In part, I think, because of the trending in social media, there's a lot of disenfranchisement that affects this area. And people are very concerned, especially young people, college students who are saying, wait a minute, here I am getting my education and someone's having to pay for it. It's a lot of money. And will there be that safety net available for me, my family, and for my future? So it really resonates. And people do want to see themselves reflected in these positions. And I think our community is becoming more aware of that, whether it's Latinos, Asians, women, people of color, LGBT community. I think people out here in LA understand that this is a very diverse community, and that it's time to be reflective of, you know, the leadership has to be reflective of that population.
Right now, there is only one Latina on the city council in Los Angeles, and you were the first Latina in the U.S. cabinet. You're part of essentially a small but growing group of Latinas in politics. And there are a lot of people who are working to make this happen, specifically with things like hashtag Latinas Represent. So why should Latinas get more involved in politics?
As you know, I served in the House of Representatives. And while I was there, there were very few Latinas. And we're seeing that actually our numbers aren't increasing, even though our population is. And there's actually more Latinas voting and more Latinas that are actually opening up their own businesses or their entrepreneurs. We're finding that there's only one governor right now, and she's out of New Mexico. She's Republican, however. There is no Latina who serves in the U.S. Senate. And we only have 9 Latinas out of 78 women in the Congress that are currently serving us now. So you can see that there's a vast underrepresentation of Latinas. And at the local level, it does vary. I think the statistic that I see at the state level is that we only make up 1.1 of state senators and representatives, which is appalling. Which is really appalling. So we have to do better. We have to make it easier for women and Latinas to be able to get elected. There's still that glass ceiling that exists that prohibits us from making that leap, from making that jump. And a lot of it, I don't want to say it's cultural. It's also economics. It's also about having other mentors that help provide that guidance and sophistication that's needed for women to make that leap, particularly women of color.
In terms of Latinos and politics, let's talk for a moment about President Obama. So he just delayed his reevaluation of his deportation policies, which is being roundly criticized by activists. At the same time, he's also being applauded for naming Julian Castro as the HUD secretary. So when you step back, how do you think that this administration will have an impact on Latino voters on a national scale?
I think that they will continue to turn out, and precisely because nothing has happened on immigration reform, I think our community realizes that there's been a blockage there with the Republican Congress and even in the Senate. And while this discussion keeps, you know, continuing, we need to continue to apply that pressure, because in the long run, Republicans won't be able to get, the White House, because they will lack that kind of, they will have lacked that commitment and values that Latinos want to see shared, whether it's education investments, whether it's healthcare investments, whether it's voting right protections. All of these things matter to Latinos and Latinas. And if the other party does not wise up in terms of the reality of what these changing demographics means in a national level, then they're going to continue to be underrepresented. And they'll only be factors in those areas that have been gerrymandered, where they do have a lock hole, but that does not represent the entire country.
Secretary Hilda Solis, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria. Good to talk to you.
Hilda Solis was the first Latina to serve in the U.S. cabinet. She left the position of Secretary of Labor 2 years ago and is currently running for County Supervisor of Los Angeles. She joined us from her campaign headquarters in El Monte, California.
Coming up on Latino USA, those moments of racism that catch you by surprise.
We were just at a lounge, and, you know, this guy approached us, both of us, and, oh, you know, we're beautiful for black women.
How not to flirt with people of color. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Boy, tan sexy que mi amor, tan sexy que mi amor va abandonarme. Oh. happen. Soy muy sexy para ti, muy sexy para ti, el rey de cualquier parte. Soy modelo, todo está tras de mí. Mira tú, no hay rival cuando bailo. Ya cuando bailo.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. It's a typical rainy Saturday in Tacoma, Washington. Despite the weather, several hundred people crowd into a street in an industrial part of town. They're here because of the building standing next to them. It's gray, concrete, surrounded by tall fences and topped by razor wire. This is the Northwest Detention Center, and inside are 1,400 detained immigrants, most of them Latinos.
Escucha, Obama, escucha, estamos en la lucha.
The crowd out here is protesting the Obama administration's immigration policies. But inside, there's another protest going on that is quieter and much more intense. Ryan Katz has the story.
When you enter the lobby of the Northwest Detention Center, a tired-looking Latina officer tells you to put your things in a locker before you go through the metal detector. Visitors with forlorn faces sit in plastic chairs and wait for some precious face-to-face time with their family members. Some of those family members, the detainees, have been fasting on and off since early March.
Cada día es más difícil, cada día que pasa el cuerpo se va debilitando.
Juan Sena Anaya is a short, stocky man in his 50s. He says that every day that passes gets harder. Every day, the body gets weaker. He feels so weak sometimes that he thinks he's going to faint. Sounds drastic. Even so, more than 1,000 detainees at the Northwest Detention Center have been on hunger strike. They say they have plenty of reasons, starting with the food.
Huele hasta mal a veces la comida.
Juan says the food smells.
En la comida de otra sección de aquí del centro, la comida salió con gusanos.
He heard from other detainees that their food has had worms, even rocks in it.
¿Para qué quiere uno más que torturas?
He thinks that the food is tantamount to torture, that even dogs wouldn't eat it.
Yo creo que ni los perros se la comen.
Then there was the work. Detainees mop the hallways, do the laundry, wash the food trays. They basically keep the place running.
Les llaman ellos trabajo voluntario.
Former detainee Jose Moreno says that they call it voluntary work.
En el cual te pagan $1 al día.
They pay you $1 a day. He chose not to work because he found that insulting.
Porque para mí es un insulto eso.
And then there's the treatment from the guards, says another detainee, Jose Monje Piedra.
Hay unos oficiales que son muy estrictos en su trabajo.
There are some officials who are very strict, he says. They don't allow us to talk or really do anything. They tell us to shut up, or they transfer us to another section or put us in the hole. That is, solitary confinement.
Nos están callando, nos van a mandar al hoyo, nos van a mandar a diferente tanque.
In fact, that's what happened to Monje. After he got sick from not eating, he says he spent 3 days in solitary.
It was
sad to be in the hole, he says. You're alone. You don't speak with anybody. When he got there, he thought everything was over, that he'd be deported back to Mexico. Then his thoughts turned to his family.
¿Qué es lo más importante? Mis hijas y mi esposa.
That's the most important thing, he says. My girls and my wife.
No, pues...
Starts to choke up.
Te sientes feo estar allí en la huelga. Más cuando tienes tu familia afuera.
You feel ugly being here on the hunger strike, he says, when you have your family outside. Many of these complaints may sound like standard prison conditions, but Monje says that's part of the problem.
Nos tienen que respetar a nosotros como personas.
We have to be respected, he says. They treat us like criminals, but we shouldn't be because we haven't done anything bad.
Que no hemos hecho nada malo.
Unfortunately for them, not everyone sees it this way. Being in the U.S. without papers is a civil offense, not a criminal one. But the idea behind detention is to make sure undocumented immigrants show up for their court dates. ICE spokesman Andrew Munoz says, quote, "We take very seriously the health, safety, and welfare of our employees, detention facility staff, and the individuals in our care." But the detainees don't feel that way.
Porque ya hemos exponido muchas quejas, pero nunca nos han escuchado. Queríamos ser escuchados, que nos ayudaran.
We had submitted many complaints, but officials never listened, says Jose Moreno. So we decided to do the hunger strike.
Hacéramos la huelga de hambre.
They got the word out by slipping notes in the middle of legal forms when they went to the library, so officials didn't realize that they were making copies. Then they carefully handed out the copies in the cafeteria, library, medical office, and church. Once the hunger strike started, different groups would take turns, each fasting for 3 days at a time. Several detainees felt themselves pushing their bodies in ways they never expected. The pain, says Juan Sena Anaya, was as much mental as it was physical.
Que estoy así sin hacer nada, pensando solamente, y hay veces me agarra el estrés, me dan ganas como de correr, como de gritar, una desesperación, ¿verdad?
Without doing anything, Juan says, all I do is think, what's going to happen with my family? I start to tremble and shake because of all the stress and want to yell or run, but there's nowhere to run to.
Y pues como le repito, ganas de gritar, de correr, pero pues no hay para dónde correr.
In order to push through the stress, Juan would trick himself into believing that he wasn't hungry.
Me pongo en la mente, no voy a comer, no voy a comer.
He says, I tell myself, I'm not going to eat, I'm not going to eat, like that. Like it's an order to the body. It mitigates a bit the anxiety of fasting.
La ansiedad de comer.
Sometimes, says Jose Moreno, the mere fact of being on hunger strike itself would make him depressed.
Es muy triste tener que arriesgar nuestra salud para ser escuchados.
He says it's very sad that we have to risk our own health to be heard. It's very sad having to risk the only thing that we have to survive so that they listen.
Es muy triste.
But Jose says that he realized that the only way to get immigration officials to pay attention was to push his body to the limit.
Se nos ha quitado la libertad, se nos ha quitado el derecho de estar con nuestra familia, se nos ha quitado todo.
They took away our freedom, our families, he says.
¿Ya qué más podemos perder?
What more do we have to lose? We can't lose anything else. The only thing we have left is our dignity, and they can never take that away.
Lo único que tienes es la dignidad, y eso no nos lo va a quitar.
ICE says that it has been listening. Spokesman Andrew Munoz says, quote, ICE has been responsive to Northwest Detention Center detainee suggestions, including reducing commissary prices and implementing menu changes. The hunger strike ended earlier this month, and many detainees report that they have yet to see ICE make good on its promises. Still, they hope that this is the beginning of a real change. For Latino USA, I'm Ryan Katz at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, Washington.
Okay, people, now we're going to move on to something totally and completely different. We're going to talk about the very fun world of flirting, dating, and racism. You know, when someone pushes all the wrong buttons. In my career, for example, I can't even count the number of times that someone has called me a chiquita, a conchita, bonita, a hot tamale, you know, Carmen Miranda. So should I be flattered because they might have meant well with it? Or should I just plain be insulted? Our producer, Camilo Vargas, talks now to fellow journalist and writer Rula Al-Nasrawi about the microaggressions she calls flirty racism and the new etiquette of multi-culti dating.
You're Mexican? But you're so pretty.
You don't act Latina.
Ooh, Latina. Spicy.
Do these sound familiar? They didn't to me at first, until this happened. I was standing outside a club in New York City, and a middle-aged white guy walks up to me, and he says, "You're the cutest Mexican I've ever seen." Now, I'm not Mexican, and it was kind of weird that he was surprised to actually see a cute Mexican guy. And then he said, "We should get out of here before the cops get here, because, you know, Mexicans and the cops." Now, what does that even mean? That I was getting deported, or that I was getting stopped and frisked? I come from South America, where most people actually look like me, so I had never experienced something so offensive and creepy at the same time. So I'm new to this, but people of color in the U.S. are not. A few weeks later, I'm going through my Facebook feed, and I see an article on Vice magazine. Calling me a terrorist is not flirting. So I invited the author, Rula Al-Nasrawi, to help me make sense of this on our show. Rula, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me, you guys.
So tell me a little bit what experiences you had that led you to write this piece on flirty racism.
A couple years back, I was at a burger place with my best friend from home in California. These two guys approach us, and the guy that I'm talking to says that he's a veteran from Iraq, and because I had told him in conversation that I was from Iraq. So then he looks at me and says, well, I just got back from there, and you're very attractive for an Iraqi woman.
Wow.
Yeah. So a little very awkward.
Yeah.
One of those things where I was like, does he know that that's not a compliment? Is he even aware that that's just a really intense thing to say to somebody?
It's usually, okay, so the person who is engaging with you is clearly attracted to you. They, you know, want to strike up conversation, and all of a sudden, you know, a compliment comes out based on a racist idea.
Right, right. I mean, someone would make, you know, insert flirty racist comment, and then, can I buy you a drink? It just puts you in this awkward position of like, did you only want to talk to me because I look different?
We knew very well we're not the only people that have gotten flirty racism. So we went out on the streets of New York City and we found the different types of flirty racism out there. Here are some of the women we met.
You're a beautiful Spanish girl. And it's just like, so I'm not beautiful. I'm just a beautiful Spanish, in my Spanish culture.
We were just at a lounge and, you know, this guy approached us, both of us, and, oh, you know, we're beautiful for black women.
Not compliments, man. Then another pattern was full-blown exoticization and offensive generalization.
Like, what they say when they approach me is, oh my God, you look like Lucy Liu. I'm like, I look nothing like Lucy Liu. But I'm glad you're aware of one Asian actress.
So they're like, oh my God, you're just like Rosie Perez. Nothing about me looks like Rosie Perez.
Like, you have a squeaky voice. Like,
I have a squeaky voice, and I'm f***ing Spanish. Like,
she really didn't look like Rosie Perez. And then we even found men of color who also get fetishized by women.
So there was a cougar. So I have this older lady. She's gotta be in her 50s. She comes into my job. I work in at a vitamin shop. So she says like she's into Hispanic men, and she just automatically, she would just tell everybody, all my customers, that I'm her boyfriend. So it was sort of uncomfortable, but I took it in stride.
And then just straight up caricatura.
So they'll start with ni hao, and then when you ignore it, they say konnichiwa. And then they'll say, well, does this work or does that work? And they'll try multiple Asian languages and say, well, I guess you don't speak any one of them.
Then a final type where people flat out decide your ethnicity for you.
Because I get Filipino a lot. I'm actually full Vietnamese. And they're like, you don't even look Vietnamese. You don't have the Vietnamese nose. Like, you have a big butt for an Asian. And I'm just like, oh.
Like, oh, what nationality are you? Oh, I'm Indian. No, you can't be. You're too tall.
So Rula and I got curious, and we decided to ask guys how they go about flirting. Rula and I bumped into some sailors, and she told them about being catcalled a terrorist.
Right. The officer wouldn't call you a terrorist.
Yeah.
But come on. Yeah, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Do you comment on the race at all? Or
no.
Do you
no.
Not
no.
Even say
are you
okay.
serious? No. Are you serious? So that, honestly, if you're attracted to somebody, you obviously wouldn't take that in consideration, right? Because you're attracted to them, right?
Right.
Some of the people we talked to had their own suggestions for flirting etiquette.
When you think stereotypical thoughts or racist thoughts, there's a line between immediately coming out with it versus keeping it to yourself until you reach an understanding, until you don't think them anymore and want to just come out with it.
You're beautiful
for who I am.
Yeah.
You appreciate the way that I look.
Right.
Doesn't matter what color I am. I think it's just unnecessary.
Being called exotic makes people feel different.
It comes off offensive most of the time because it's like, oh, you're exotic. Well, guess what? There's actually 1.1 billion of us.
You look exotic. Like, you look like you're just into extraordinary things and you're just like out of the ordinary things.
As Rula points out, exoticization is offensive and it doesn't even make sense anymore.
Especially in the U.S., it's like this is a diverse country and it shouldn't be as much of a thing. It's 2014, so to still be called exotic is like, where are you from?
Yeah. Rula, thank you so much for joining us here on Latino USA.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Rula Al-Nasrawi is a contributor at Vice, The Atlantic, and Galore magazines. And we want to hear your experiences with hashtag flirty racism. Tweet at us at Latino USA and tell us your story. Today, queridos, we want to end on a high note. And there's nothing that pushes the boundaries like a good victory. For this week's Sabiduría, or Words of Wisdom, we hear from 16-year-old David Rodriguez, who competes regularly in the Special Olympics Texas, along with his mother, Mercedes Maldonado, who talk about the joys of winning.
Oh, I got plenty of medal. I got, like, I think, like, 17 medal, gold medal. All right, my name is David Rodriguez. I'm 16 years old. I live in Grand Prairie, Texas. And I love playing a lot of sport like soccer, basketball, bowling for the Special Olympic Texas. Okay, on track and field, I do powerlifting. It's the ball made of metal and it's a little bit heavy. So you got to throw it like from your face and from your hand and then go up and down. And then after that, you have to throw it as far as you can. Those balls are heavy.
Since he born, he was diagnosed with seizures, but after a certain time, the doctor gave us the good notice that he doesn't have any more seizures. And the reason that he is on the Special Olympic is because he's receiving the speech therapy. But I feel so proud of him.
Soccer is the best thing to do because it could go everywhere, like, that's the way how I like it.
Always he's talking with me about, I don't know if you know Messi, Lionel Messi.
When I first saw Messi join the Barcelona team, first of all, he was number 19.
And always he said, Mom, one day I'm going to be like him.
He scored several goals. And I know how many goals he scored, like 300 goals.
And I say, yes, you will, but you need to practice. You need to get a lot of disciplines.
Oh, and so he played for Argentina. He's ready for the 2014 Brazil World Cup.
Before of the game, he always tell me, "Can you pray for me? Because God gonna give us the victory."
We did a great job. We worked so hard, play hard, because the other team they were a hard team.
And when he got the medal, he raised his hands to the sky. That's very, very particular on him, and I feel so proud of him.
Special Olympics athlete David Rodriguez and his mother, Mercedes Maldonado, joined us from the studios of KERA in Dallas, Texas. And, queridos, that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, AC Valdez, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Mitra Kaboli. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. And special thanks to Jed Kim. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. And join us again next week. And in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on my Instagram. Hasta la próxima, mis queridos.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
But I could look like somebody random, right? Like Kim Kardashian. I could look like that, right?
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.